Good morning and welcome. I'm Christopher Purdy, pleased to welcome you to today's edition of All Sides Weekend Books. It's been quite the busy morning of the last 24 hours, but we're going to talk about new books today, books that you may have discovered under the radar, some good reads, whatever. And one of the best reads that I've had recently, and Cassie Rose, thank God, agrees with me, is a new novel called 4th of July Creek by Smith Henderson. Can you give us a little rundown of this, Cassie?
Sure. It's a great story and takes place in a small town in Montana outside of Missoula. Protagonist is a social worker who goes in and out of homes where people are a bit desperate, you could say, alcoholics and into drugs. And he watches out for the kids, sometimes has to remove them. His own life, it goes in parallel to it. And his marriage is bad, and he and his wife are alcoholics, and they have trouble with their daughter. And this all sounds dreary, but it isn't. Christopher, I think you described it very well when we were talking about it. It's like you get involved watching this train wreck and you just can't turn away. He realizes, though, he is recreating in his own life what his job is all about. But you can't pull away from it.
No, it's a real page turner. Mm-hmm. The author is Smith Henderson. He's a young author. I think this is his first novel.
Yes, it is.
And I just happened to have a brief interview that I did with him on the telephone yesterday. Let's hear from Smith Henderson, the author of 4th of July Creek. I've never been to Montana, but after reading your book, I feel that I have. You have an incredible sense of place. Is that something you developed or something that happened by itself?
I didn't feel like it was a legitimate place to write about, really, for a while. When you grow up in a place, you don't necessarily see what's different or special about it. It wasn't until I moved away that I really recognized it as kind of this interesting, special place.
The premise of the novel, part of it is a young man called Pete Snow who's fleeing a bad marriage, who is kind of estranged from his only child. He's a social worker. Sounds like he has to cover most of a big state anyway. There are not a lot of social workers out there. And he meets Benjamin Pearl. Tell us about Benjamin Pearl.
Yeah, he's this boy that showed up at the local school in this small town of 10 Mile, and he appears to be almost feral. You know, he's coming in from he's covered in really like filthy, kind of raggedy clothes, and he's very suspicious. But for some reason, he's been drawn to this school, and he's been wandering around the hallway, and the principal finds him and calls up Pete to come and figure out, you know, what to do with him, because no one knows who this kid is.
But Jeremiah Pearl, his father, is a rather complex and really frightening kind of a character. Were you, first of all, can you describe Jeremiah to us, and did you know people just like him?
Jeremiah is a pretty paranoid survivalist type guy living in the woods in northwestern Montana, and he's pretty much convinced that the end of the world is pretty nigh. He's holed up out there waiting for, you know, the inevitable signs of the, you know, end times. I didn't, you know, personally live in the wilderness with, you know, survivalists or anything like that, but Montana has got quite a few people who, you know, live off the grid and want to, you know, want to be, it's a state that's really independent. And so, you know, I don't know, I was privy to a lot of conversations, you know, growing up that were, you know, speculating about the nature of, you know, the federal government or the international conspiracies or different theories about, you know, how the world's ultimately gonna shake out. It's pretty normal conversation in some cases.
I mentioned earlier that Jeremiah can be rather frightening. He's the father of, I think, 6 children. His wife's kind of scary. She's very much a disciplinarian. She's very, very attuned to the rapture and salvation and better times coming. But it seems to me that Pete and Jeremiah develop some affection for each other later in the novel. Is that accurate?
I think they come to understand each other. You know, that was one of my goals as a writer was to create these characters who were constantly, regularly making mistakes and being very flawed, but still finding yourself rooting for them and hoping that they'll turn out all right, and that, you know, you have empathy for them. And I think part of that was having them grow to understand one another.
While Pete is busy tending to Benjamin and to a lot of other children in his care, his own daughter in another state disappears, and we find her living on the streets. So there's a parallel story there. Was that deliberate? Did you begin the premise of the book with these two stories, or did that develop later?
You make these choices, and you see how they're going to shake out. You know, for a while, maybe sometimes you can go the wrong way with something and realize it's not working and have to get rid of it. All the way up until the end of the novel. So everything's always up for grabs. But I did know that I needed Pete to have something other than just an obsession with his work, that had to have consequences in his personal life. And the consequences for him is the fact that his daughter just has taken off and doesn't want anything to do with him or her mother.
Also, this is your first novel. It's a huge success. How are you enjoying success?
I feel most proud and happy about the fact that the book's finding some readers. You know, because you start out in a place where you're hoping that your obsessions and enthusiasms, you can just get them on the page in the way that you intend them, and then the next thing is just hoping that people share those. And so I've had the opportunity over the last couple months since the book's come out to meet people who've read it and, read about people who are writing about it. That's been fantastic.
Well, 4th of July Creek by Smith Henderson, your first novel. It shan't be your last. It's a wonderful read, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay. That was a chat that I had yesterday with author Smith Henderson, a very young author who was having a great success with his first novel, and Cassie Rose agrees with that, which makes me feel good. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic, and her blog is thelongestchapter.com. She's a guest on today's All Sides Weekend Books, along with Kevin Griffith, who is a poet and professor of creative writing at Capital University, and Mark Maxwell, who's a manager of Half Price Books on Bethel Road. And you are not allowed to go into Mark Maxwell's store and ask for free books, okay? Don't do that. All right, I said last time you could, and apparently you can't. So, but go there anyway. Welcome all, and thank you for being here. Any last words, Cassie, about 4th of July Creek before we move on?
Only that it is, I mean, we say many times that a book is well written. This definitely is well written, but it's not in like a highbrow way. It's not overwritten. It truly does just draw you in because you're fascinated with these characters and this social worker, as well as this Jeremiah Pearl and what's going on with him, out in the wilderness. He also creates so well the lives in Montana and the weather that is going on, the snowfall, how the people deal with it. This guy, the social worker, he is walking miles to see these kids through snow, through mud. But you never feel a sense of burden or heaviness from him. It's his work. He embraces it. And again, as you said, you're just watching this train wreck and just fascinated by it.
I'm thinking Johnny Depp. But
yes,
anyway, yeah,
yes,
probably
yes.
Johnny Depp for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Griffith, what do you have for us today? You always come with a wonderful stack of books for us.
Well, I thought I would start with something that I thought was a really great read. I had picked this up, very popular book. I couldn't even bring it in today because there's such a long waiting list for it at the library. But a fun book to read in the middle of summer, Carsick by John Waters. John Waters, the film director. The film director, of gonzo films like Pink Flamingos, and Hairspray, the one that was made into a Broadway musical.
God, talk about hazing.
But,
John
yeah, yeah. Carsick is a great book. It's an amalgam of fiction and nonfiction. What John Waters did is he pitched this idea to FSG. He said, I'll hitchhike from Baltimore to my apartment in San Francisco as John Waters. So he gets on the highway and carries a sign with him that says, I'm not psycho. Cardboard sign.
Describe what he looks like, too.
Yeah. Well, razor thin mustache, a slick back hair,
yeah.
Dapper. Okay. Many people actually recognize him on the road and pick him up. But what's fascinating about this book is not so much the true part of it. The last third of the book is this actual true story of hitchhiking across the America. But the first part, about the first 100 pages, are he envisions how this trip would have gone if it met every expectation he ever had hoped for on this trip. So, like, the first person who picks him up is a drug dealer, instantly recognizes him as John Waters. John Waters talks about a film he could never make because he didn't have the money. And the guy says, no problem, and drives him to his pot farm, digs up digs a hole in the ground, pulls out a safe and gives him $3 million. And then another episode, he meets a guy who's a demolition derby driver, and the cops in the car, and they immediately go to the stadium and begin crashing into things. And really over the top, he meets this woman who specializes in selling from her car coverless books. Remember when they used to do that? They take the cover off the paperback book and say, do not resell.
Right. If you bought this, you bought a stolen book. Right.
Apparently, there's this whole underground collectors of these books, and they drive to a guy who's made his house out of these books by gluing them together, the walls. But this is just a crazy book, Karsak. If you're looking for something that's light but really well written, because he's a good writer. And a very creative guy. So this is a really imaginative work, and it's got it all. It's got fiction, it's got nonfiction, it's wonderful.
Hasn't he also befriended and supported one of the Manson killers?
I have no idea.
Yeah, one of the women in prison who's been in prison for 50 years. Apparently, they're not romantically involved, but he's been part of a sort of attempt to get her paroled or something.
I can imagine he would be. Yeah.
And he made the point on the radio that, you know, he was going into very conservative parts of the country, and he's John Waters, and he looks like John Waters, and one of his best buddies was a serial killer. I don't mean to laugh, but it's just the irony of it in that book is really wonderful. Karsak by John Waters, and you're right. I mean, if I haven't read it, but if it's he's always good for
it's
stimulant. Yes, yeah. Stimulant. And speaking of stimulant, here's Mark Maxwell from Half Price Books, all of the stores, particularly yours, are always very busy, very crowded. Lots of eclectic people going there. What are they reading?
They're reading an awful lot right now. Summer is our busy season. I brought a book that I've been recommending to my customers. It's one that I'm really excited about. It's called The Martian by Andy Weir. The Martian it was just published this year in hardcover, but my understanding is that it's been building momentum for a couple of years as a self-published ebook. It's about the protagonist is an astronaut. He's part of one of the first manned missions to Mars. The mission is cut short when there's a freak dust storm on the surface of the planet. The astronauts have to pull out and get back to their vehicle. On the way, though, one of them is struck by a piece of flying equipment. It actually punctures his spacesuit. It digs into his side. His crewmates witness this and think that he's been killed. They reluctantly leave Mars and go back to their ship. And of course, he's not dead. He's still alive. He makes it to his shelter, which is just a temporary shelter that they've built on Mars. And there he is. He's there with limited resources, no way of contacting Earth to let anyone know that he's still there. It's very much kind of Robinson Crusoe on Mars. There's a lot of great science in this book.
Is it sci-fi?
Yeah, it is okay. Science fiction, great. and it emphasizes the science in science fiction. There's a lot of great chemistry and orbital physics and even botany in this book. Mm-hmm. It's told in a very informal style. I don't want to say conversational. That's not quite right. It reads like a blog post, and in fact, it's structured as kind of log entries from this astronaut. Much of the book is. So it's by design, but there are possibly more exclamation points than one really wants to see in a novel. It's really compelling, though, and I couldn't put it down. It's a really thrilling story.
The Martian by Andy Weir. That's a sci-fi book that Mark Maxwell is warmly recommending, and I'm interested in that because I don't read a lot of science fiction. So if you're out there and you're a science fiction fan and you have recommendations for us, it's your turn to call 614-292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Again, 292-8513. Science fiction fans and not science fiction fans are all welcome to call. We're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment with more of All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Kevin Griffith, with Mark Maxwell, and with Cassie Rose. We've been talking about Cassie Rose's blog, which is thelongestchapter.com, and we've been asking for telephone calls from people who can recommend science fiction titles or science fiction fans, or if you want to recommend a cookbook or a biography or a romance novel, we'd love to hear from you. It's 292-8513. I'm not much of a science fiction person. If I were going to start reading science fiction, where would I begin?
Dune by Frank Herbert is probably the greatest science fiction novel. It's part of a series. Frank Herbert went on and wrote a few more of them. His son Brian is continuing the series now. But the first book, Dune, is probably the
best. What's the premise? Very loosely.
It's kind of a political dynastic thing. The main character is the son of a guy who's sent to take over a desert planet. There are lots of different factions kind of vying for power in a galactic system. It's really well done. It would probably be appeal to fans of Game of Thrones. It's quite well written. There are lots of great sort of environmental statements, and it's just of all the kind of classic science fiction books, it's probably the most engrossing, the best written.
It's about 20 or 30 years ago.
Oh, something like that.
Okay.
Probably a little more.
Cassie,
more
than that, you have in your bag Jules Verne and
20,000 Leagues Under the sea.
Right. He might be the father of science fiction there. And I mean, it's not something I would have expected you to walk in with. And here you are.
Yes, I sort of surprised myself on this. But it's just yesterday I was reading a blog post it was The Guardian. And this person was saying one of the best beach reads is 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And reading this article, it was like, yeah, I haven't read this book. I would love to pick it up. They're talking about adventure and excitement and about how this oceanic scientist goes and in search of some monster or something that is taking down ships all over the world, only to find out that it's a submarine and this, you know, crazy mad Captain Nemo, and he gets captured by this Captain Nemo. And I thought, well, that sounds really interesting. So I went to the library and picked up a copy and brought it along with me. And of course, now in the meantime, I've talked to Mark, and he's sort of gives it a mediocre review in terms of, you
I'll
know,
probably get in trouble for that.
Yeah, right.
Mark said that Dune was the greatest sci-fi novel.
Yes, but in reading about this too, though, I mean, Jules Verne did influence Ray Bradbury and
sure.
some other of the great sci-fi writers. I'm still intrigued to read it. I have not read much of Jules Verne. I haven't read anything of Jules Verne, so I kind of want to.
Well, next
get
time
him
you're
my...
you're going to give us a book report next time.
Okay.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and Mark Maxwell may or may not agree with you there. We have a call from Jerry, who we're changing courses just for a moment to recommend a biography, but we are talking about science fiction. We don't have to stay there, but we're talking about science fiction today because I know nothing about it and would like to learn. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, hi Jerry, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember Charles D. Casey Stengel, manager of the Yankees and the Mets.
He slud.
And the book is, quote, "You Could Look It Up," unquote, by Maury Allen, because that's what Casey used to always, when he talked, he'd say, "You could look it up." And it's a great read if anybody is a baseball fan, and I don't know if I'm talking to any now, but you got an old bone here that's closer to 90 than he is to 80, and this is just a great read. And he was became a director of Glendale Bank in California, and on one side of his desk it said Charles D. Casey Stengel. The other side it said Stengelese spoken here. Any of you ever heard of Stengelese?
Haven't heard of Stengelese. I have heard of Casey Stengel.
Okay.
But
that's what they called what he talked about. And it's just a great read. And if you like sports of any kind, because he was a character back in the day when we don't have characters in sports anymore. We got multi-million dollar, you call them what you want to. But by the way, I did want to mention the Sasquatch, because last week I saw, you know what Sasquatch is, Bigfoot?
Right.
Yeah. And they were talking about seeing one up around Hartwick's Pine State Park. And Miss Fisher, I'm sure, knows where that is, north central Michigan.
Jerry, I'm sorry. We do have to move on.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
But I'm glad for the recommendation of you could look it up, the biography of Casey Stengel. Here on All Sides Weekend Book, our number is 614-292-8513. And we do have a sci-fi recommendation from Chris in Clintonville. Hello, Chris.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My recommendation is a book called Leviathan Wakes by James S.A. Corey. It is the first in a currently four-part series. Fourth book was just released. It is a hard sci-fi novel. The series is called The Expanse.
How many books are in the series right now?
There are currently four. The fourth one came out last week. I'm just about to finish it. The first novel, Leviathan Wakes, is sort of a noir detective story mixed with a thriller and action sci-fi. It is kind of straddles a line between all of those. It is extremely well written and extremely interesting.
Terrific, Chris. Give us the author's name one more time.
It is James S.A. Corey.
Very good. Thank you, Chris from Clintonville, for the recommendation. We're talking about science fiction, but we can talk about other things, too. I wanted to ask Cassie Rose about two titles that are currently featured on her blog, thelongestchapter.com. But before I do that, I want to ask Kevin Griffith if he has another recommendation for us, science fiction or not.
Well, as long as we're talking, I thought this was a great book. It's a slim book, and we were talking about characters like Casey Stengel and how we don't have them anymore, and science fiction writers. So here we go, Kurt Vonnegut. Science fiction writer. A new book just came out. It's a collection of Kurt Vonnegut's graduation speeches. Apparently, he was a much desired graduation speaker at many colleges. The book's called If This Isn't Nice, What Is? Advice to the Young. It's just a hoot. For instance, I'll just read you a little passage from one of the graduation speeches. This is from his speech at Fredonia College in Fredonia, New York in 1978. And here's the beginning of the speech. This is great. Your class spokesperson has just said that she is sick and tired of hearing people say, I'm glad I'm not a young person these days. All I can say is, I'm glad I'm not a young person these days.
I know what he means.
And it's filled with that kind of levity and fun. But he also has some really interesting prescient views of the future and the effects computers will have on people. In one graduation speech at Agnes Scott, he talks a lot about predicting the ill effects of computer on education and the only way a child can actually be taught is with a loving, well-educated human being. So there's a good mix of that sort of humor and one-liners. Here's another great one-liner that he had at a speech. Would those who believe in telekinetics please raise my hand? It's an incredibly fun book by one of the great science fiction writers, one of the great writers and characters. It's called If This Isn't Nice, What Is? Advice to the Young by Kurt Vonnegut. I really enjoyed reading. I'm a huge Vonnegut fan, and if anyone is, they should definitely check it out.
We thank you for that recommendation. And Cassie Rose, on your blog, you had a couple of new nonfiction titles featured that were intriguing. They may be science fiction if you think about it a little bit. One was by John Dean of the Watergate era about what Nixon knew and when he knew it.
Mm-hmm. And the Nixon defense.
It's the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation come up in a few weeks. So did that look like an intriguing book to you?
It does. I mean, it's a big one. It's a doorstopper closing in on about 800 pages. But he's working with new transcripts. He's working with, you know, getting into the archives. And it's, you know, who knows, you know, once we get into it. But it is being positioned that if you want to know what was going on in that 18-minute silent period during the Nixon tapes, you know, he's got the answer for it or is providing that information. And he's providing what, you know, he thinks Nixon knew and didn't know about the break-in in 1972 in Watergate. And I think that kind of stuff is fascinating. I think that's why I like reading the Robert Caro books about his series on
LBJ.
LBJ. Because now enough time has passed. You know, Dean was the White House counsel during that time. And it's just fascinating to read back on and look at it and bring it to life again. It was a very colorful time. That is a tame way to say it. But the 60s and the 70s, everything in politics that was going on, people were riveted to their TV sets, let alone to the Washington Post with the Woodward and Bernstein articles and Deep Throat and who was this person that was feeding the information to the reporters at the Washington Post. I remember my grandmother just had the TV going all the time.
My parents did too. Mm-hmm. This was like during the day. People stayed home from work to watch these hearings that were going on during the day. And also, Mrs. John Dean got a lot of commentary because she was very beautiful. And he had a hot young wife, let's face it. And she became a figure in the, I don't think she ever said a word, you know, she became a figure in the whole Michigas there. Yes.
So something, I think that this is just going to be a great book. You know, it's the dog days of summer that are coming up. And if you're a nonfiction reader, it's something, I think, to put on your radar screen.
Terrific. Now, Mark Maxwell, you're probably not old enough to remember the Watergate hearings. So tell me what else you have for us to read.
Actually, I would recommend John Dean's memoir that he wrote right after leaving the White House, Blind Ambition, is a great introduction if you're not familiar with Watergate. I brought the long list for the Booker Prize was just released.
The Booker Prize is what?
The Man Booker Prize is a British literary award. It's one of the most prestigious literary awards in the world. This is an exciting year for the Booker Prize because for the first time they've expanded the field to include any books written in English. So American authors are eligible for the Man Booker Prize for the first time ever. And four American books have actually been included in the long list. I brought one of them with me. It's been on the bestseller list recently. It's called To Rise Again at a Decent Hour by Joshua Ferris. It's the story of a New York dentist who is kind of a grumpy and unpleasant person. He has a childhood tragedy that involves his father and the Boston Red Sox. He has trouble sleeping. He has some unhappy relationships. He has kind of a great relationship with the elderly dental hygienist who works in his office who shows him one day that someone has made a web page for their practice, which kind of gets his ire up even more so when the web page starts to feature sort of vaguely religious quotations. So in the process of trying to track down the author of the website, he comes into contact with a religious group that has been trying to get his attention for reasons that are kind of obscure. So it's a funny book. The unpleasantness of some of the characters is made up for with the cleverness of the prose, which is quite readable. Some reviewers have found echoes of Philip Roth in there, and I kind of see that. To me, the plot is a little like maybe The Crying of Lot 49 if you replace the protagonist with a middle-aged dentist. It will not win the Man Booker Prize, is my prediction, but it is worth your time.
Do you think it'll make the short list?
No.
Okay. Because it's the long list out now. There are 13, and they whittle it down to 6?
Yeah.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see if any Americans are on
the short
list.
Maybe the Karen Joy Fowler. And if she wins the Man Booker Prize, she could be the first person to win both a Man Booker Prize and a World Fantasy Award, which is a pretty difficult trick, I would think.
Joshua Ferris, right?
Joshua Ferris, To Rise Again at a Decent Hour.
We are delighted to have that recommendation and happy to hear from George in Columbus on the phone. Hi, George.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
I've got a couple of recommendations for you for people who, especially folks who maybe have not had much experience in the genre. A newer one is Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. That's a movie now, but the book is extraordinarily good. I can't say as much for the sequel to it, so I'll let everybody decide on their own there, but Ender's Game is an extremely good book. There's another one that's out on loan to one of my students right now that's called Ready Player One. And I can't remember the author's name, and I can't look at it because my copy is on loan right now. But that's extraordinarily good, and there's something in there that Columbus readers will enjoy very much when they read it. There's an older book that's about almost 60 years old now that's called The Stars, My Destination, a novel by Alfred Bester. And that's, a very, very good, a very, very good read, short, good beach book because you can read it in just an afternoon. And I would also recommend for anybody who enjoys a nice, close, neurotic-feeling book that they should probably try some Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Philip K. Dick, certainly. Yes, yes. George, thank you so much. You've given us four recommendations, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Mark Maxwell, you were champing to say something about these recommendations.
Yeah, Ready Player One is by Ernest Klein. It's a wonderful book. It's a few years old. It is rapidly becoming a nerd classic. I do second the recommendation for Philip K. Dick, though. I think Philip K. Dick is an amazing writer. His later books are extraordinary. He in the mid 1960s, he had a little bit of an episode where he actually thought that an alien satellite orbiting the Earth was beaming instructions down into his brain. And his later novels were fictionalized accounts of things that he thought were actually happening to them. And they're amazing, and everybody should check them out.
Good to know. Good recommendation there. We got time for one more call before our break, and this is from Ed from Baltimore. Hi, Ed. You're on.
Yes, good afternoon. There are two books, actually. The first is, and I don't have it with me, so I don't know the name, it's called The Rebel Raiders. It's the story of the Confederate Navy and the machinations that went in to get the Alabama off and into raiding the whaling and the merchant ships of the North during the Civil War. It's a part of the history that most people really don't know about. Most people know of the Confederate state ship Alabama, but there's really nothing that's ever been fleshed out. This is the first book I've seen that does that. It's about a 10-year-old book, which I picked up at the library.
Oh, give me the title and author one more time.
Okay. I don't know the author. The name of the book is Rebel Raiders.
Rebel Raiders, okay. And you had something, Smells Like Dog?
Smells Like Dog. It's a 2-year-old book or so. It's a juvenile fantasy, young adult juvenile fantasy about a young boy who idolizes his uncle Drake, who's a treasure hunter, and he dreams of becoming a treasure hunter. His uncle is mysteriously murdered, and the only thing that comes down to the boy as part of his possession is a basset hound, which apparently cannot smell.
Oh.
And I picked it up from the library only because of the title, and the cover is a basset hound with a crown on its head, and I like to read books about animals. It's a totally different way. It's kind of a combination of an Indiana Jones, Wizard of Oz type of book. Very fantastic characters, very interesting plot. It moves along fairly quickly.
And you can't beat that. You can't beat that for a title. Smells Like Dog. Ed, we have to move on, but I do thank you very much for your recommendation and your call. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We'll be right back after we take a break, and we'll have more calls. We are back for our final segment on today's program with Kevin Griffiths, professor of creative writing and a poet at Capital University, with Mark Maxwell from Half Price Books. I should read your shirt because I can't see it behind the mic. And Cassie Rose, whose blog is thelongestchapter.com. And one more title on your blog that's intriguing is the story of James Joyce's Ulysses.
The most dangerous book.
Right.
Why was
that the most dangerous book?
Well, when it was published, it was considered to be blasphemous in a way. It covered all the minute details of life, and so it was banned.
Yeah, underline all. Yeah. Yes.
And right now, we wouldn't flinch at that, but back in, you know, the first part of the 20th century, it was horrendous. And so it was banned, it was censored, it was burned, and he had a whole cadre of friends and supporters that were behind it and trying to get it published in the United States and in Britain. And there was a huge obscenity trial that went on, I think, about 1933. So it's the story not only about James Joyce, in the writer of this book, and what he went through to write the book, but also what happened to it in terms of the reaction and how there was this trial to, and I don't think it was called an obscenity trial, but it was about the fact that it was just so scandalous and trying to get the book published and out to the readers.
I think it was denounced also in the Congressional Record.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think really the scandal of that book, and I think that's a good term for it, was pervasive.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's just a difficult, knotty, K-N-O-T-T kind of book to unravel. But I read it last year, and I'm so glad I did. It was like listening to my grandparents 40 years ago, sitting in their kitchen table. So, although they didn't talk about the things that James Joyce obliquely or otherwise talked about. We have a call from Jonathan in Columbus. Jonathan has a recommendation for us. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I have two specific recommendations and one general. Specifically, the book Flatland by Edwin Abbott. It's almost 100 years old now, and it's an excellent book for understanding different perspectives. And the second specific one is by Ursula K. Le Guin called Lace of Heaven. And that's a good book about how hard it is to change the world. And finally, I'd say that anything by Isaac Asimov feels like it's pretty relevant to today's world.
Yeah, those are very good. Le Guin and Asimov, very good recommendations, too. Can we talk a bit of those two authors?
Sure.
Mark Maxwell.
Yeah, Isaac Asimov was an amazingly prolific science fiction writer. He's maybe the classic science fiction writer. He wrote hundreds of books over the course of his lifetime, lots of classic sci-fi, the iRobot stuff. He wrote the Foundation series, which is really popular. He also wrote a lot of great nonfiction. He really cranks stuff out. He's got books on history. He's got a book on the Bible, which is fascinating. He's definitely worth checking out. I would second the recommendation for Flatland, too, which is a science fiction novel about geometry, which is pretty rare.
Chris is on the line from Westerville, and we've upstaged him a little bit, but I want to get Chris's phone call there anyway. Hi, Chris.
I was going to say something about Isaac Asimov, but like Mark said, he's a well of a man. I mean, you can't plumb the depths of everything he's written. It's pretty wild. But also, I was going to recommend Jeff Noon.
Jeff Noon, okay.
Yeah, Jeff Noon, N-O-O-N, just like the Noonday Sun. There's a book by him called Vert, and that's really good. I like that a lot. It's kind of a sci-fi. It definitely borders on the fantasy side as well, but it's really good. I recommend it to anyone. It's kind of got he's kind of cutty edge, like snarky. He makes fun of a lot of different things in his own kind of special way, the way all good sci-fi does. So I really recommend that, and he's got several other books after that, but Vert, V-U-R-T, is a really good one.
Thank you so much, Chris, for the call. I wonder if these books are what Mark Maxwell would call nerd reads. What did you call nerd reads?
Sure. Yeah, nerd fiction.
Nerd fiction. Very, very good. Yes. We have calls coming in now, but I want Kevin, because Kevin Griffith always brings a very eclectic mix of books, either with comedy, mm-hmm. there's a little irony there, poetry. Mm-hmm. So what do you have for us next?
I wanted to talk. Again, interesting literature. This isn't science fiction, but it's literature, but it's really interesting, defies genre. This is the latest collection of stories by Lydia Davis. And Lydia Davis is a translator, mostly known as a translator of Flaubert and Proust.
Madame Bovary.
Yes, incredible. If you're looking for an incredible read, read her translation of Madame Bovary by Lydia Davis.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. But as a short story writer, she is way out of the box. And if we're talking about awards, she's one of the MacArthur Genius Award winners. And if you want something that's different on every single page, read a collection of short stories by Lydia Davis. And she runs the whole gamut from very long stories to incredibly short stories. Some of her stories are just basically a sentence long. I'll read you one right now, a complete story by Lydia Davis. This one's called Bloomington, like the city in Indiana, Bloomington. Now that I have been here for a little while, I can say with confidence that I have never been here before. That's great.
All right, well, hang on a second. Now, pardon me for my ignorance, but how does that rate as a short story to be put in a book? Come on.
Well, versus like a prose poem.
It's a sentence. Give me a break. Come on.
Christopher, if you just don't get it, you're just not a genius like me.
I mean, I know that. I'm a little more practically oriented sometimes.
Well,
but
fiction's pushing a lot of boundaries now, and that I would call that like an aphorism, actually. And
I don't know what that means.
Aphorism is a short, pithy statement that somehow rings with a universal truth. And aphorisms are really popular in the fictional world now. In fact, I've just been asked to contribute a chapter of a book on aphorisms. So short stories are all over the place. From one sentence, we'd call them stories.
But someone can't get lost in it. Someone can't sit down with, you know, mm-hmm. a cup of coffee in the morning or at night, you mm-hmm. know, and escape into a one-sentence story.
Yes, but that's why they're in a collection. And so when you look at the totality of it all, I think she's wonderful, and I'm always looking for things that are really different. And yes, stories should be able to get lost in a story, and you should be able to get lost in a novel. But you should also have a story that's short enough to make you smile a little bit, but then resonate for a long time afterwards. And maybe you get lost in thinking about Why did she write such a short story?
I'm not resonating over Bloomington. Clearly, she's not paid by the word. But anyway, if you recommend her, I'm sure there's
Lydia
a lot
Davis.
To it. Lydia Davis.
Even if you don't care about short stories, do read her translation of Madame Bovary.
Madame Bovary, yeah. That's
she's
that's
a great
harrowing
translator.
Read there. 292-8513. We're running a little bit out of time, but if you want to make a quick call, you're welcome. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. You are welcome to talk about short stories of one sentence or many more than that. And we have a call from Kim in Upper Arlington. Hello, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I had two recommendations, neither of which is science fiction. The first one is fiction, and I read about a book a day. So
wow.
This is probably the best fiction that I've read in the last year. It's called Where'd You Go, Bernadette? And it's by Maria Semple. It's just a very, very funny, unfortunately, it's not one sentence, very, very funny novel and very unusual, a lot of twists and unexpected things. But then as far as nonfiction, I think that the best book that I've read in the past 3 or 4 years is 1861 by Adam Goodhart, which is about the first year of the Civil War. And the reason that I would recommend it so strongly is because it has a number of links to Columbus, which I've lived here for 40 years, did not know 90% of them or how very important Columbus was in the Civil War and how integrally linked to it.
1861, was this published recently?
It was published in 2011 because that was the 150th
right.
anniversary of the Civil War.
And the author again?
Adam Goodhart. Exactly
Adam Goodhart.
Like it sounds.
Okay,
sounds
listen,
good.
Thank you so much, Kim. That's a great recommendation. Thank you. Thank you for
bye-bye.
The call. We're talking about books on today's edition of All Sides Weekend with Kevin Griffith, with Mark Maxwell, and with Cassie Rose. We are running lots of gamuts here between short stories and science fiction and nonfiction. And in the remaining 7 minutes we have, I want each of you to have a chance to plug a favorite we haven't talked about before. Cassie Rose.
I think I'll share with everyone The Last Night at the Blue Angel by Rebecca Roetert, R-O-T-E-R-T. It's a new book out in July. This is her first book. It's 1965 Chicago, and it's about a singer at a Chicago jazz club and her relationship with her daughter. And she's obviously, like most entertainers, she is in love with her career, and that comes first. And her daughter as the narrator, who is 10 years old, is sharing her view of it. It's a very moving book. It's also a very easy read. It's very fast-paced because you get into the time and into the relationship. And her mother is, you know, you wouldn't be surprised as a singer. You know, she's into men, she's into drinking, and she's into her career. But there in the middle of them is a man named Jim, who's a photographer, going around and taking photos of all of the Chicago buildings that are being taken down that are architectural beauties. And he is based on a real person. And I'm forgetting it. Rick Nichols, I think, is his name. I think that's I would have to look in the book. But anyway, it's very interesting because he takes her, the little girl, to the buildings, the Chicago Stock Exchange and the Armory, and taking the photos. It's told from the viewpoint of Sophia, the 11-year-old, as well as from the singer Naomi. It goes back in time to how the singer got to where she is. It's a very good book. It's not a page-turner. It's just a very good book and very resonant of the time.
And the title and author one more time.
It's called Last Night at the Blue Angel by Rebecca Roetert.
Do you know Rebecca Roetert? Is this her first novel?
It's her first.
Okay.
It's her first novel.
Then that's another name we will look for in the future.
We can watch her career.
All right. How about you, Mark Maxwell?
I've been recommending to my customers a graphic novel called The Carter Family, Don't Forget This Song. We call it a graphic novel, but it's actually nonfiction. It's the story of the Carter Family, this seminal early country group. There's some great stuff in here about country music, about the early days of radio and the recording industry. It's drawn in kind of a simple, minimalist style, which I think is well-suited to the subject. And it's bound in a handsome volume by Abrams, which is a publishing company that is best known for doing just really excellent art books.
They were a great family, too.
They were.
In terms of music, they were tremendous. So
indeed.
So this is really a biography of the family.
It is. It follows their career from the beginning to the end. There's a lot of great material from the period. There's some really interesting stuff about the relationships between black and white musicians in the segregated South. It's kind of a slim volume, but there's an awful lot of information packed in there.
Glad to know about that. We have an email from Paul. He thoroughly enjoyed reading the biography of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. I looked at the recent movie about Steve Jobs and was completely turned off. But that book has gotten certainly a great deal of play, and it's been on my reading list for a while. And for sci-fi, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
sure,
by Douglas Adams. Now, I think I read that many years ago. Why does that ring a bell with me?
It's a classic. It's short. It's funny. It's part of a series. Sadly, we've lost Douglas Adams, but everybody should read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
And that email came from Jay. You can send an email to allsides@wosu.org. And how about you, Kevin? What do you have for us?
A good beach read, a good straightforward narrative. This is by a German author, Julie Zay, who's won the Thomas Mann Prize. It's called Decompression, and it's a great beach read, 200 pages, straightforward, Patricia Highsmith-like mystery of a diving instructor who's tried to get away from it all, moved away from Germany to a small island off the coast of Spain, started his own sort of diving retreat center for the rich and famous and well-connected. And so a soap opera actress named Yola and her husband, who's a writer and much older, come to take lessons from him for 2 weeks. They're obviously in a very abusive, codependent relationship. Her husband immediately begins thinking she's having an affair with the diving instructor, and then there's some indication that she might be cultivating this misperception to get back at her husband. And it's really great. The noose tightens as the narrative grows and as we reach the end of the conclusion. Also, just there's lots of suspense and just lots of great underwater scenes, just very intricately detailed scenes and details about how to survive in great depths that are interesting to read. And it's not a overly detailed book by any means, and it's a quick read. Decompression by Julie Zay. I would say it's a very good book.
Mm-hmm. And I thought of you last night. I met a wonderful poet named Nicole Seeley, who was reading at the Lancaster Festival. And we talked about poetry, and it made me think of you. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking we'll do a poetry show someday. I think that would be
great.
Kind of interesting to do that as well. One great read that I had that's been in the news lately for a sad reason, the book is called Unbroken by Lauren Hillebrand. It's about a gentleman called Louis Zampieri, who was a GI. He lived in captivity from the Japanese in a horrendous situation during World War II, and he had been a track star. In fact, he ran at the 1936 Olympics and actually met Hitler when he was a teenager. Sad because he passed away a couple of weeks ago at the age of 97. But this, I really recommend this book very much, The Unbroken by Lauren Hillebrand. She wrote the story of Seabiscuit. That was wonderful last year. And we have an email. What do you think of the sci-fi writer Octavia Butler?
Yeah.
What do you think, Mark?
Let's see. Octavia Butler is a well-known science fiction writer. She's also known as kind of a feminist writer. Her best-known book is Xenogenesis, I think. Maybe one of her best-known books, and it's highly recommended. It's often assigned in college classes and whatnot.
Well, I thank you all. We've covered a lot of ground here between nonfiction, new fiction. We talked to Smith Henderson, the author of the new novel, A Fourth of July Creek, that's getting a lot of attention. I haven't seen it yet on the bestseller lists, and I'm kind of waiting. I think it may start getting to the bottom and working its way up in a week. It hasn't been out very long, the book, so I'm looking forward to that. That was a good read about Montana. We talked about graphic novels. Remind me, Mark, of the Carter Family one again, because that sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, it's called The Carter Family, Don't Forget This Song.
Great country music dynasty there in
right.
a graphic novel. And Kevin brought us, remind us of the Vonnegut title.
which I thought was great.
If this isn't nice, what is? Advice to the young, Kurt Vonnegut.
Advice to young. Those are his graduation speeches, his commencement addresses. Mm-hmm. I thank you all, Cassie Rose. I thank you, Mark Maxwell. I thank you, Kevin Griffith, for being with us on today's edition of All Sides Weekend Books. My thanks to producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, associate producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trainin, and Emily Williams. And thank you all for listening to Classical 101's, it's not Classical 101, that's in an hour, to All Sides Book here on 89.7 NPR News.